Sky News Centre at 5. Jeremy Corbyn's refusing to step down after Labour lost the Copeland by-election in Cumbria. Elizabeth Williams reports.
Truly a wonderful victory for the Conservative Party.
Theresa May basking in Labour's humiliating defeat. Many are blaming Jeremy Corbyn. John Woodcox, the MP for neighbouring Barrow and Furness.
Everyone in the Labour Party should be hugely concerned. We've had a devastating defeat.
But the Labour leader wasn't having any of it.
Have you at any point this morning looked in the mirror and asked yourself this question, could the problem actually be me?
No.
Labour did manage to hold on to Stoke Central, beating UKIP leader Paul Nuttall.
Leicester's caretaker manager Craig Shakespeare denies he'd fallen out with Claudio Ranieri before the Italian was sacked by the club. He says it's not important whether he thinks it's the right decision. Ranieri's left 9 months after winning the Premier League title, with the side now battling against relegation. Shakespeare also responded to suggestions of a player revolt.
A lot of it has been speculation with no foundation. My relationship with Claudio has been perfectly fine all the way along. I've never had a problem with him. He's never had a problem with me. I spoke with him last night on the phone. He actually thanked me for my support.
A man who shot a crying toddler in the head with an air rifle has been jailed for 2 years. 25-year-old Jordan Walters pleaded guilty to inflicting grievous bodily harm on the boy in Bristol last July. The mum of a banker who was killed by a single punch says the last 6 months have been a nightmare. A man's been jailed for 6 years for killing Oliver Dearlove in southeast London. The boss of Peugeot has come to the UK to give assurances about the future of Vauxhall should his firm's deal to buy it go ahead. He's had separate meetings with the business secretary and Unite Union leader. And the price of stamps is going up by a penny next month. First class will cost 65 pence, while second will set you back 56p. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
BCFM 93.2 is 10 years old.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol.
Oh yeah. This is
BCFM 93.2.
I made the radio rock.
Bristol's finest.
It's Friday, yes, it's 5 o'clock, folks. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news is former Cabinet Member for Finance and Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley's Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, The Guardian warned last week, even beyond the Snoopers Charter, which is now in law, Theresa May is still not happy. She's pursuing a new and unprecedented attack to criminalise journalists and whistleblowers and taking Britain down a path to a police state. How do you protect yourself from an NSA cyber attack, whether or not it's blamed on Russian President Vladimir Putin? My acronym is PREFABS: passwords, real privacy, email, firewalls, air gaps, backups and software. We'll do our best to run through these latest two bricks in Big Brother's war for you tonight with lands rights and privacy journalist Kevin Carhill. Also, the threat posed by the cashless society. And Russian-born philosopher, author and filmmaker Andrei Vilcek's got a new novel out based around an Indonesian painter, Aurora. It's an attempt to show the David and Goliath struggle here in the West against the cultural vandalism, the acres and days of safe, bland art now being commissioned and promoted here. Plus, author of The Shadow of the Crescent and historian on Islamic architecture, Yaqub Zaki, was in Bristol the other week, and I was walking back with him to the bus station. He started to talk about another passion of his: revolution, politics and secret societies, the Templars, the Masons and the Triads. In some ways, it was more interesting than the interview I did with him in the Lord Mayor's Chapel, so I whipped out my voice recorder just before he caught the coach back to London. Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 11, wet and windy tomorrow. Sunday will be drier, but also windy. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, some sunny spells, but also lots of wet and windy weather next week. Next weekend, 4th and 5th of March, highs of 10 Celsius, sunshine and wet and windy again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is former Cabinet Member for Finance and Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henleys for the Conservatives, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
First of all, what do you make of these two by-elections today at Stoke and Copeland?
Well, intriguing results. All sorts of comparisons that it hasn't been for 35 years that an incumbent government's managed to win a by-election. It was or take a by-election from an opposition party.
Well, so, the BBC are calling it historic.
So it is. It's pretty amazing. I have to say, I think it's frightening. I think as a Conservative, I think we need a strong opposition and a popular opposition that's able to argue its case. And sadly, to find a Labour Party that's jubilant at having beaten UKIP in Stoke is actually quite a remarkable state, and one that I don't think is good for the political scene in the UK.
Well, there's another side to this, Martin, isn't it? And it's that you've got these rather... Should we say stupid? Am I allowed to say that? Labour MPs who are just sort of giving up their seats in order to, as they have done now, give this victory to the Conservatives.
Well,
I mean, I can't imagine a Tory just giving up their seat and saying, let Labour have a go at this seat.
Well, that's symptomatic of the divisions that exist within the Labour Party. Can I just say that the Conservative victory in Copeland is partly because you've got a very good candidate there who is a local doctor, and is also opposed to the closure of the maternity unit. Can I just finish?
Why hasn't Labour bothered to get a good enough candidate?
The Labour candidate was a local person, but the interesting thing politically for me is that the Conservative victor, who is a local doctor, is also opposed to the closing of the maternity hospital, which was the key local issue. So I think it's a good result for the Conservatives and a good candidate. But also, of course, that candidate is critical of government policy on the NHS.
Well, you say that was the key local issue. The locals don't say that. They say that Sellafield and Jeremy Corbyn's lack of support...
Well, no, but can we come back to the Sellafield issue? I'm opposed to nuclear power, as are many Labour activists, but Sellafield is under no threat whatsoever, because there's going to be... There are reprocessing plans, and we're going to be reprocessing nuclear fuel for many generations to come. So there's no danger to Sellafield, whether you're pro or anti-nuclear. It makes no difference.
So don't you think Jeremy Corbyn should have been a bit more forthright in his support for it then?
I don't think Jeremy Corbyn appearing... I mean, don't forget, as you pointed out, Tony, both Tristram Hunt and the chap in Copeland that resigned were both anti-Corbynistas, and they resigned essentially to force by-elections to create problems for the leadership. You know, we could moan and groan about that.
So how many more are these going to be before the next general election? People just, in a way, sort of stabbing Jeremy Corbyn in the back by deciding, oh, I've just had enough of this.
Well, I think what Jeremy Corbyn should have done at the very beginning is commit himself to proportional representation. It wouldn't make much of a difference in these two kits. Seats, because if you presume that UKIP votes would switch to Conservative
and
vice versa,
he can't do PR, can he? He can't bring PR in. In fact, we had
the point is, you could change the dynamic completely if you were to commit to that. That would leave only the Conservative Party of all the major parties committed to first past the post. And I think when you've got a more than two party system, which we now have, and we've also got a four country system with four different political systems, I think you've really got to start thinking about them. And of course, and when we're having elections for the Metro Mayor or the Mayor of Bristol, you have a transferable vote. That's the way to go forward, to change the dynamic of the debate, so we're not forced as a Labour Party to be constantly fighting with each other, because
so
we've got
the system,
a different perspective.
It's not the candidates. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I think it's always interesting to hear these stories and excuses, and we've all been there at different stages where we've had to defend an unfortunate result. But I think blaming the system is not the answer. Let's face it, there is good reason to believe that Conservative voters in Stoke actually voted for the Labour Party in order to make sure that UKIP didn't win. So let's be honest, people were using their own form of voting.
It's tactical voting.
It's tactical voting. And I come back to, actually, it's the country that's suffering, because what we need is a strong opposition that is able to help bring about strong government, particularly at these times when the negotiations with the EU are going to need a lot of involvement from both sides of the House of Commons, both political parties, and it's going to need people working together and from a position of strength. And sadly, if one party is so poorly placed that it gives all the power to another party, then I don't believe that's good for the country's future.
Well, the indication here, Martin, is Jeremy Corbyn's not up to the job for 2020, is he?
Well, the fact is that he just won a leadership election, so there's no chance whatever he's going to be removed.
Well, he's got support from within the Labour Party membership, certainly, but this doesn't look as if he can win elections.
Well, don't forget, we've had two attempts to remove him in two successive years. It's perfectly legitimate for the left wing of the party, which I would call myself a part, to say, look, it's the, you know, when Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson pipe up the week before these local elections and say they don't think Corbyn should be the leader, that's not entirely helpful.
When you say there's been two attempts to remove him, what do you mean by that? There's only been one attempt to remove him since he became leader.
Well, all right, there's been one attempt, but he's won twice is what I mean, and neither time has anybody, and in actual fact more people joined the party the second time in order to cement him in place.
Doesn't it indicate that the Corbyn Labour Party is becoming a ghetto?
I think there's a real problem of communicating our message, but I still come back to questioning the system. There aren't just two parties in the system anymore. There really isn't. And if you add the UKIP vote and the Conservative vote together in both constituencies, as I've done, they would, and then of course you've got to imagine that the Liberal Democrat and Green votes would have gone to the Labour Party, then the Conservative Party would have just won both, which is fair enough. But at the same time, what would have happened probably if we'd had a PR system, there would be two Labour parties functioning.
Change the
now.
System.
But we haven't got two Labour parties,
Martin,
we've only got one because of the electoral system.
I take what you say about communication, because at the top of the hour in the Murdoch News, we heard some comment about these by-elections with one of the Sky presenters actually speaking, and only Jeremy Corbyn only being given the opportunity to say the word no, that being their news clip. What do you think about? Do you think Jeremy's getting a fair deal from the London media? Jeff?
I think the whole issue of the media and their influence on the electoral process is something that we need to seriously examine.
Be here all night, couldn't we?
Yeah, we could. And to be honest, the media has disproportionate influence, with three or four newspapers calling a great deal of calling the way that people will vote, and actually they should be, in my view, the media should be informing people but not actually shaping and telling them which way to
totally
vote.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah.
And that I feel unhappy with, even when they're telling them to vote my way. I don't feel happy that is actually how the democratic process should work. People should be developing their own understanding of where we go.
If we look at BBC Question Time, for example, we've seen precious few Corbynistas on that panel. I mean, you tend to get a panel of sort of whatever it is, five or six people, almost all of whom, like watching last night, thinking even Angela Rayner doesn't seem to be four square behind Jeremy Corbyn. And there seems to be a general perception. I mean, particularly, I mean, I'm thinking about Prime Minister's Question, for example, on Five Live on Wednesday. We heard a panel of MPs, none of whom was pro-Corbyn after it. So the media is bound to have some sort of influence, isn't it?
It is, and you've got to expect that. I mean, if you're on the radical left, as Corbyn is, you're going to have an uphill struggle because you're going against the grain of the established way of doing things. And that's one of the reasons why, in my view, he should have committed to PR at the beginning of the process. He didn't, and I think we're going to get there in the end because we've got it in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales anyway, and for mayoral elections.
I mean, there's also
we're
the
going
fact.
To get it
there's
in the
also
end.
The
can,
fact.
I just interrupt a moment there? Because Martin keeps saying we've got PR for the mayoral elections. We haven't. We've got a very strange second vote that counts if you happen to have guessed who the second candidate's going to be. That isn't any form of proportional representation. Well, it's a very, very peculiar compromise that was negotiated by the Liberal Democrats. And I have to say, my experience, most of my voters don't understand the process and I don't have a clue that many people use their second vote for the same person as they voted the first time round, and others use it to make votes for someone who clearly was never going to get through to the second round. So they don't understand the process.
Well, I agree that it's not ideal. It's just a way. I mean, but the mayoral election in Bristol, I think, it was a second round vote that won it this time, was it not? For Marvin, he had to have transfer votes in order to win, didn't he?
Yeah, but he was ahead on both counts this time round. But all I'm saying is it's a very small portion of the second votes because most of the electorate don't understand it. And I think that for democracy to work, you actually have to have voters understanding.
Well, they've got to work it.
I mean, the process works. And I've heard even amongst local politicians actually trying to work out a strategy on how you would recommend people to vote in their second vote, and it's almost impossible to come up with a conclusion.
That's if you can persuade people to vote in the first place, Jeff.
And the turnout in Stoke Central was abysmal for a by-election. 37%, something like that.
Martin, do you think the tactic of Labour doing everything they could to block UKIP in Stoke has backfired here? Is that why?
Why
because they put all their efforts into Stoke and they've lost Copeland.
Well, I think they're both very specific constituencies with a very specific demographic. So, you can't expect that what would work in one place is going to work in the other place. And I think the fact that UKIP and UKIP's votes seem to go to the Tories in Copeland, and the Liberal Democrats seem to take the Labour vote in Copeland because of, for whatever reason. But I come back to my previous point, there isn't just two parties in the system, certainly not in Scotland. There are only two parties in the system in Scotland, and the Labour Party isn't one of them. So that means national politics is therefore that much more complex. And I think the idea that people can't understand a transferable vote, everywhere else in Europe they do, in Ireland, Denmark, Sweden, anywhere, people know, and people know how to use it. I mean, we'll have to get, if you're going to have a system, you're going to have to get people used to using it.
Maybe that's our job to explain it a bit better,
that's right.
But if I just come back on that, if it was a single transferable vote where you actually put your parties or candidates in order, whilst I don't actually, I wouldn't support that, I at least can understand it and see the rationale. The system we currently use in our mayoral elections is beyond the comprehension of most electors and is random.
Well, we've now got a bit of a dog's breakfast of a setup, haven't we?
We have.
I mean, in Northern Ireland, they fight elections under several different systems, depending upon what election it is. And all the activists on both sides understand both of those systems because they have to. And, of course, the turnout in Northern Irish elections is far higher than it is in the rest of the country because everybody knows it matters. Yeah. They realise that it's important.
Okay, on to City Council, and Bristol City Council has set a budget this week for next year, which means we now have a definitive hit list of 112 cuts that will raise. I don't know why the Evening Post, the Bristol Post, used this term. Will raise 33 million. No, it will cut 33 million. In fact, here is the list of the savings. No, here is the list of the cuts. I don't quite know how they can massage cuts to be savings. This is just, I suppose, the perspective of some bespectacled accountant somewhere at the runs the Bristol Post, or is the editor's chief or something. I mean, it's just, this is massaging the truth. And that was, I would imagine, quite a fraught meeting on Tuesday, Jeff.
It was a fraught meeting because no one from any party comes into local government with a view to cutting public services.
So do you feel a bit like, should we say, the sort of people who are closing down a company, official receivers, slowly, bit by bit, taking bits off?
That's certainly how it feels, and there is a real, real concern that within a period of 5 to 10 years, one will end up with local authorities only providing social services and not being in a position to provide any other services.
Well, like not the parks, nothing, basically.
Absolutely. And that, I believe, is bad for the community, bad for the whole being of a city like Bristol, because actually we need everybody contributing and everybody benefiting.
So what have you got to say to your colleagues in Westminster? This is them, isn't it?
Well, part of it is funding and austerity. I understand why central government has to balance its books, but I also recognise that there becomes a point at which local government ceases to be viable. So I have a concern that is going to come about. But meanwhile, there are ways that Bristol as a local authority has to carry on looking at whether it can run itself more efficiently and more effectively, streamlining management and ensuring that it directs resources to frontline services, because that's where it's got to be spent.
Well, obviously, I mean, we could go into the rationale for austerity, but I'm glad to hear you say that we don't want to see local government eviscerated. And as I said earlier,
but Westminster do, don't they?
Well, I think the fact that local politicians like Jeff here don't agree with that is to be welcomed. I mean, we've got to try. I mean, they've loaded the cuts onto local government, haven't they? I mean, they could have cut other things, but local government has been taking the
brunt.
Given
that Jeff doesn't agree with it, what are you prepared to do to change things, Jeff?
Politically, we can lobby central government to encourage them to reconsider. In reality, that is only going to make a very modest difference. So the alternative is to work within the City Council to continue to look at ways of making it more efficient and more effective.
I mean, we're talking about £33 million pounds worth of cuts next year. We had Tim Kent in here from the Lib Dems a few weeks ago saying it looks like there may be no money coming from central government by 2020, by the time of what's probably going to be the next election. This is the sort of thing which created what we had in Ukraine, which was the Maidan protest back 3 years ago, where people in the regions say, well, what's the point of us paying tax to central government, income tax or whatever, when that's not coming back to
it's
us?
Not, it's bad, but it's not quite that bad, in that what happened until a few years back is that we got a rate support grant from central government, but central government kept all of our business rates. And what they're doing now is allowing us to keep our business rates, but they're not giving us a support grant. So it's not quite so bad in the sense that we are being allowed to keep more of what's generated. But local government across the country is questioning because it is not being allowed to retain enough money to make it viable and to actually make it provide what the community needs.
So do we have to just bend over and do what we're told?
No, we have to keep on arguing the case and explaining it. Local government has to produce a balanced budget. So it doesn't have the option. A hospital or a health authority can actually run at a deficit for a year or two. It's got a balance in the end, but it doesn't have to year in, year out, whereas local government has to, and therefore it can only operate within those parameters.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, we've got to try and build a consensus that local government is not just to be treated as a poor relation and messed around, and that's got to be across parties. And I come back earlier to the Copeland by-election, and I imagine many people will have voted for the Conservative candidate because she was firmly opposed to a cut in a local NHS hospital. Again, it's not local authority, but it's still a local issue. Let's hope that she's able to persuade the government to stop cutting
the maternity hospital. How long are people prepared to tolerate a government that just acts as a kind of interest collector for the banks? Because that's effectively what's going on here. We heard last week, didn't we? £40 billion a year now going in interest payments, £1.7 trillion national debt. This is where all this money's going. When we pay our taxes, it's not going to pay for services. It's just going to service this debt from 2008.
Not entirely true, Tony, because in actual fact, the interest rates are so low that if they were higher, it'd be a lot more. The fact is that the economy is still growing because we had a splurge of quantitative easing after Brexit, which most people haven't taken on board. We had another fix of heroin, and therefore the economy carried on going. But there's no more heroin, and of course there is very likely to be an economic crisis before there is a general election, and then we'll see how competent the government looks when it happens.
How about this, using this quantitative easing money, Martin, to pay off the debt rather than just to increase the price of property and shares?
These fundamental... I mean, we've been doing these shows for 8 years now, and Jeff has been coming on for that time, and we've had this debate about what should be done about the banks.
So why can't... Just answer the question. Why can't the QE money be used to pay the debt off? Because it's increasing, the way the QE money's being used now.
Martin can explain to me, because it's even more baffling than that, because the money is being used to buy the debt rather than to repay it, which and I have to say at that point, I'm lost as to what happens in the cycle.
Martin, help us out here.
What we're doing, in brief, is we are basically bailing out the pre-existing financial institutions and their interests. we could have just let them collapse and used the money for something else. But if we did that, then there would be a hiatus. And because the US government and others agreed to bail them out, they're then still there. This is Milton Friedman's argument against bailing out failing industries, because you don't just bail them out once, whether it's a car industry, a steel industry, or the financial services sector. Once you've bailed them out, they are there as a continuous lobby to demand further resources. And they're too politically powerful. They'd have been too politically powerful for a Labour government. And, of course, they're much too politically powerful for a Tory government when they largely fund their political activities. It's very difficult to deal with them.
Jeff? Yeah. But, I mean, this highlights the predicament. The reason behind austerity, the theory, is that it's a way of reducing the debt. In fact, we haven't succeeded in doing that yet. So we still have a situation where that debt is increasing.
But you could argue that the purpose of having the debt is to make sure that austerity continues, because people at the top, those that work through the financial system, have got wealthier as a result of this. They haven't lost out. And the whole system of an ongoing crisis like this allows them to milk the system, basically.
That might be, but they also get wealthier under a Labour government with public spending going up. So actually, they get wealthier.
Well, I mean, that's one of the fundamental problems we've got, is the distribution of wealth and power in the society is not based on any kind of fairness.
Anyway, my two halfpence, come on, let's use some of this QE money, pay off the debt, and then we can start spending money on things that matter.
What the argument is, what people talk about is people's QE. I mean, that's what, if there is a further crash,
or just
people's
write,
QE is going to come onto the agenda.
Or just,
instead of just giving money to the banks, maybe you should give it to people,
or to local authorities, or whatever. Just write the debt off, folks.
The thing about a crash, Tony, is it writes the debt off. But it's in a very destructive fate. Well, there should have been an orderly bankruptcy procedure for these zombie banks, but we didn't do it. And of course, they're still there as zombies.
This week we had, and it'd be interesting to get Martin's comments on this, the chief economist at the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, was speaking, along with Mark Carney, at the Treasury Select Committee, which is chaired by Andrew Tyrie. Before we hear from Mark Carney, let's hear from Andy Haldane and see if he comes up with any sort of useful answers for us that Martin can then comment on or add to.
I mentioned earlier on that we, at the time, we looked at a range of possible trading arrangements and just took the average of those in the absence of any better judgment at the time. It's true that the debate on this has moved on and is moving around, and perhaps we could have done a rather more subtle re-averaging of the possible range of outcomes.
But I don't think you'd describe leaving the single market and the customs union as something requiring a bit of subtle re-averaging, would you?
The reason we didn't make any shifts in that set of assumptions is because when we played through the impact that would have on our forecasts, the impact was relatively modest. Not least because these outcomes are some point into the future, and therefore that impact telescoped back to today on our forecast over our policy horizon up to the 3-year point were relatively modest. We will keep them under review, and I think as the debate moves at some point in the future, perhaps we will change those. But for now, I think suffice to say that even if we had adjusted them, there would not have a material bearing on our inflation and output projections, and therefore on our policy.
Therefore, on our policy. That's Andy Haldane. It's quite depressing listening to him, really, because it mostly just seems like gobbledygook. Martin, do you trust this guy?
He said some quite sort of outside-the-box things about the creation of money supply and so on. So he's actually quite an interesting character, Andy Haldane. I mean, people have got to remember that we've had a 20% devaluation in sterling, and we've also had an injection of QE, and therefore there doesn't seem to have been much of an effect from Brexit. But of course, the 20% devaluation in sterling is going to feed through into inflation, which won't be fed through into wages, which will have a deflationary effect. But it won't just happen overnight. The real problem is if Monte Dei Paschi in Italy collapses this week, there will be an effect through the euro system, which will then affect the City of London, etc. And all of this is actually more likely to happen than an agreed Brexit. And we've been talking about Brexit. I'm bored with Brexit. It's largely irrelevant. The real problem is the banking system, which we were talking about in the previous segment.
Jeff, what do you make of people like Andy Haldane, Mark Carney? Does that sound like gobbledygook to you, or do they make sense?
I wouldn't say it makes sense sufficiently that I could explain it back again, having listened to it. But I believe they're the best we've got to be interpreting where we are and what we're doing.
Well, what he's effectively saying there is, we're sorry, we thought it was going to be a bit of a disaster after Brexit. Economically, actually, things are looking a bit better than we thought, and we're sorry. I suppose that's it in a nutshell.
I think the problem is...
That's what he was saying, Martin.
It actually, no one can tell at this stage what Brexit is actually going to mean in terms of the economy, because until the negotiations take place and there's an understanding of whether of whether there is a free market or whether there are tariffs, until we know what the impacts of those are, no one has the faintest idea. And therefore, actually, this is... And you know, economists... And I'm not being offensive to Martin, because I'm an economist as well in the past. Economists are extremely good at interpreting things in an infinite right. number of ways. But at the end of the day... No one can predict this, because the most obvious thing any economist will use when they make a statement is other things being equal. Well, the one thing that's certain is that no one knows how other things are going to perform, particularly when the rest of Europe could disintegrate around us. So we could end up with, in fact, nothing to leave if things go on the way Europe's going at the moment.
Well, Brexit or no Brexit, I'm sure Martin Summers will be predicting a crash at some point soon.
Well, I will, because there's no other possibility.
I'm more likely to agree with him now than I have been in the past, but I still think that the economy is actually a lot sounder than people have been prepared to admit.
More sound than before Gordon Brown in 2008?
No, that was the sound. That was then an extremely sound and well-based economy. I'm not convinced that the economy has recovered from that recession and is as strong as it needs to be to cope with what may come.
You don't think Gordon Brown did save the world in 2008?
I have never been convinced on that score, in the same way as I was not convinced that he had ever worked out how to beat the economic cycle, and circumstances proved that he hadn't.
I thought the city of London ran rings around him and still do. Anyway, Mark Carney and the rest of them, and Mark Carney now at the same committee, and this is such an important thing, isn't it? You know, whether we're the economy, the money, what are you doing with the money we give in our taxes? Are they doing something sensible with it? Mark Carney puts himself forward as this guy from the Bank of Canada. Of course, he's not. He's actually from the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank in Basel in Switzerland, which there was a vote at the Bretton Woods conference after World War II to close down because they... BIS had been used, Mark Carney's bank had been used to finance Hitler's rise to power and also provide Germany with much needed foreign exchange right the way through the Second World War. So this bank was supposed to be closed. It's not. Mark Carney was its head of regulation in the run up to the 2008 crisis. So in many ways, he's the guy responsible for this mess we're in. And here he is speaking this week. Weren't those sort of questions asked to him, though, by the Treasury Select Committee? And here he goes in his replies.
There is a scenario around the forecast where the economy proceeds smoothly to a bold, ambitious trade deal. That's the core objective of the government. That is well anticipated by households and increasingly anticipated by businesses. So uncertainty effects start to dissipate. That is a scenario that is consistent with. Faster growth relative to forecast, higher inflationary pressures relative to forecast, and tighter monetary policy relative to forecast. That's obviously it's a good scenario. That is raising interest rates for the right reason. There are other scenarios which would be less optimistic or less positive, which could mean that policy would be on a different path than that, could be on a looser path relative to what we've set out. But I think it's important to recognize that there are scenarios where this process proceeds relatively smoothly to an increasingly clear endpoint, and that would be consistent with a higher path of interest rate.
So I wonder, Martin, do you think he's paid his wages just so he's, because he's the guy that can spend a minute and a half saying almost nothing?
Well, that's the job of central bankers. You don't seem to realise they have to say nothing, because if they say anything substantial, they could cause a car crash. So you've got to read between the lines of what central bankers say. They're inevitably going to be very cagey and deliberately obfuscatory, and it's no point complaining about that. That's their job.
Jeff.
Well, there were comments there about interest rates going up, and that's always going to be a threat in the not too distant future. And one of my worries is that if we find the bank using interest rates as a mechanism for controlling inflation, when the inflation is simply being caused by the devaluation of the pound, then we could get ourselves into an economic cycle of interest rates going up, which in itself will not be based on a sound economy as such, or a growing economy. It'll be based purely on the on what's happened to sterling, and that would be very unfortunate if we get into that economic cycle.
Also, Jeff, you were mentioned in this report on the council's finances, which came out last week. It says Jeff Gollop was also in the firing line, although there was a monthly reporting to the assistant mayor. I guess that's... No, hang on. You're the deputy mayor, aren't you?
Yeah, but I was the assistant mayor responsible for budget and finance, so yes, that was me.
And so there was monthly reporting to you and half-yearly reporting to Cabinet. It provided very little opportunity for emerging problems to be identified at an early enough stage for them to be addressed. Did that just mean that you and councillors, other Cabinet members, weren't reading the papers?
Well, there are... I don't believe it means that. There were certainly paragraphs in the report, one of which said, over a sustained period of time, officers did not display the degree of professionalism that the mayor and Bristol City Council members were entitled to expect. There was another that said that things were lost in reports, and not necessarily presented in the clearest way. There's another that says that there was information about agreed savings which were not being delivered, but members weren't told.
So where did this £29 million go? I mean, you were in charge of finance at the time.
Where did it go? Well, it was spent when it should have been saved, is the answer.
But I mean, if you're getting monthly accounts, you must be able to see what's happening with the money.
What the report also says is that the reports that were coming in didn't tie in with the underlying accounts.
Okay, so there's a mismatch between what's actually being spent and what you're getting.
There appears to have been a failure in the flow of information through to members.
Well, the Section 151 officers, the people who are supposed to make sure all this stuff does stack up and that councillors are presented with the correct figures. I mean, surely the reason why we've got this missing £29 million is because, partly anyway, to do with the fact that we've had this churn. Apparently, I mean, I don't have the names, but three different Section 151 chief finance officers for the City Council. I mean, that's just an appalling record.
It certainly doesn't. It did not help, and it's got to have contributed to the problem.
How
do we end up with...
Yeah, how do we end up with three different people who are supposed to be in charge of the finance? It does begin to look, doesn't it, as if these people have gone because, and possibly because they've been presenting figures which aren't right. You would wonder what pressures there are on them to do that. They're just, I mean, are they like the sort of generals surrounding Hitler that would always tell him what he wanted to know?
I don't believe so. I mean, if we deal with the issue about the turn, once a vacancy arises in a post like that, the policy was to recruit someone on a temporary appointment, because otherwise you would be waiting 3 or 4 months for an appointment to take place. So you end up with an interim appointment. You then try and go through the selection process. The council found that it was not able to attract people at the salary it was offering to fill the role, so it therefore took longer to advertise, and it required a review of salary levels for the role, and therefore it took significantly longer to appoint a full-time appointment. You've highlighted all the significant weaknesses that come from not having an appointment, but once you have a vacancy, you have to go through the process of appointing as and when you're able to do so.
Martin, what do you make of this, the fact that the council officer we employ to look after our finances has been leaving, reappointed several times? And I wonder, maybe afterwards I ought to put this to you, Jeff, why, if you think that that may not happen in future, because that would be nice to know. Anyway, Martin.
Well, obviously I'm a bit of an outsider on this. This has taken everybody by surprise, even those who are in the loop like Jeff. So it's we're not quite sure what's happened here. But obviously having people, you know, in key positions like that, you know, not having a stable person there obviously doesn't help.
But the effect is that it looks like whilst the city has voted for a Labour mayor, Marvin will be implementing something like double the cuts, effectively, that George Ferguson was.
Well, that's possibly, I mean, obviously the political point you could make is, oh, well, what George Ferguson's done is he's just loaded it all onto his successor. But I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that, you know, sometimes the situation is just pretty dire. And, you know, whatever you did, you're going to find it's very difficult to keep everybody happy when you've got to make swinging cuts, which nobody wants.
And some people might say, Jeff, that, you know, whilst George did a bit of creative accounting to try and ameliorate the worst effects of the central government cuts, Marvin is going for broke. He's going to absolutely make sure that all these cuts are implemented, which is not what you would have hoped. You would have hoped that he would be pushing back in a similar way to George Ferguson.
Well, I mean, firstly, I can say that we were certainly not trying to do any creative accounting. I believe local government finance is so complicated that it needs to be transparent and clear, and that was my view. That didn't happen, but it was what I was trying to make happen, and there was certainly never any intention to conceal. Marvin, I believe, is doing what has to be done to produce a balanced budget, and that involves looking at accounting treatment, which is part of the budget process. But ultimately, to balance the budget, you have to look at the income you've got coming in and making sure that you're only spending that amount of money. So he hasn't actually got any alternative. The budget papers last year flagged up that there were going to be £20 million a year of savings having to be made in the coming and the next 3 years, and that was forecast. What wasn't forecast is the £29 million that are savings that were not made, and that couldn't be forecast because at the time of the report, councillors were not aware that was there.
What about drawing on reserves in order to get rid of the worst effects of these? Because, of course, these cuts always nowadays fall on the people who most desperately need government services, don't they? The poorest, the most vulnerable in society.
Indeed, but there's a danger that you fall into the trap set by people like, for example, the former Secretary of State Eric Pickles, who thought that local government reserves were just large pots of cash that were available for use. Government reserves are all local government reserves are actually all allocated for specific purposes. So actually, you can't just go in there and dig into them and use them. They are allocated and will be spent on certain purposes. So they're not there to be used. And if you do use them, you've got to replace them the next year. So that is.
Hang on. Over the last 4 or 5 years, we had a big increase in our reserves, though, haven't we? I mean, surely, you know, if you get some sort of unexpected disaster, you can't say that the money was already there for that specific disaster because you just don't know where the disaster is going to come from.
No, but you've got to have reserves there to cover a variety of potential issues. And I say some of those reserves, I mean, take one, for example. One reserve is the is for the revaluation of property owned by the council. That isn't a reserve you can use because the property is still owned by the council. It's gone up each year since the recession because the value of property has gone up each year. But it doesn't mean you've got that money there to spend. So, and there's a whole series of other reserves of the same nature, which is not money that you can actually, it's not bankable, it's not usable.
So £33 million worth of cuts. I'll put a link up to where those cuts are. Quite a good double-page spread yesterday in the Bristol Post explaining them all. And we've got the Metro Mayor elections coming up in May. But I thought we'd just have a look at the tasering of Judah, which is this horrific incident which went all over the world, actually. People all over the world looking at our police tasering this guy in the face. Because apparently police aren't taking it seriously enough to suspend the officers involved, Martin.
Well, I think that's possibly unwise. It seems to me that they shouldn't be tasering people in the face under any circumstances. That's a misuse of the weapon. And I think that, you know, they might want to reconsider that.
Jeff?
Well, I must admit, I thought I had read that they were being suspended, but I can't recall where I read that. Clearly, there is something here, and actually, it shouldn't just be because it was a high-profile case. It actually should be an issue that this is controlled very, very carefully. Tasering, I would have thought, is clearly not quite as significant as armed police, but it's still pretty significant, and the processes for its use should be very well established, very clear within the police force, and should only be utilised in extreme circumstances.
Let's just clarify this, because the police officers who tasered the Bristol grandfather, Judah Adunbi, have been served with gross misconduct notices, but they haven't actually been suspended. So hopefully that clears things up with that. But anyway, Martin, this isn't very good for our local police. And also another story this week from the Post. Bristol sees the biggest rise in debt problems in the UK. David Clancy writing earlier this week, it's just Bristol's seen the biggest rise in number of people seeking to help for debt over the last quarter, according to new data. UK Personal Debt Index, compiled by debt support organisation Credit Fix, has found throughout quarter four, that's the last quarter of last year, the percentage of people who own their own home fell to 8.5% of survey respondents, compared to previously when it was 10.5%. It also tracks the level of people receiving support across the UK's major cities. Bristol was identified as the city with the biggest quarter-on-quarter increase, while Edinburgh experienced the biggest fall in the number of consumers accessing debt help, with a drop of 34.9%. Well, used to work in the debt business.
I used to work for Bristol Advice Centre briefly. Well, it's worrying, isn't it? And I think probably it's to do with the cost of living in Bristol, isn't it? It's an expensive place to live, as I know to my cost. And it's, there's lots of, reasons why people end up in debt. And, the cost of living for people on low incomes will be one of the factors here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Bristol's problems stem from the success of the city. Yeah. So our traffic problems stem from the fact that a lot of people want to work here and want to travel in here. Our housing problems stem from the fact that more people want to live here than there are houses to accommodate. In parts of the country up north, there are vast numbers of empty houses. Down here, we have vast numbers of people wanting to get in on our housing list. So people are paying more in rent than they can afford. Or if they're buying a property, they're using every means they can to stretch themselves to fund that property. So it is sadly inevitable that on the back of that, you end up with people with significant debt problems. And there is no easy solution. Ultimately, I'd put this back to, we need more houses. We need significantly more houses and flats to provide more accommodation, bring housing costs down for those who are paying rent, and actually make the situation that bit easier to sustain. And meanwhile, the council and other agencies have got to work out ways of ensuring that debt counselling and support is more easily available.
Well, one thing I would say, if you're having problems with all these sorts of things, folks, it can be quite useful to have a chat to your local councillor to direct you to someone that can help you, or else if it's you feel the debt that's being imposed on you is not fair in some way or another, which quite often happens, MPs can help, councillors can help quite a lot with these things in many occasions, particularly if it's some sort of government-related agency that's involved. do turn to them as well if you don't get redress, if you have got these sorts of debt problems. I've also been trying to get MPs on over the last few months, ever since the Corbyn coup, for some reason. I haven't been able to get any of the Labour MPs to come on here, and I've heard back from Kerry McCarthy's office and also from Thangam Debonairs that they won't be able to come on. They're too busy, they say, at the moment. Only Karen Smith is the only one that hasn't replied after about 5 weeks of emails and phone calls, and also Chris Skidmore, Jack Napresti, and Charlotte Leslie have also politely said, nope, sorry, haven't got the time. So doing my best to get these MPs on, but they don't seem to want. Maybe it's just simply because there's no general election coming, they can't see the point. But it would be nice if anyone can persuade any of them to come to get our MPs to speak on the radio. It would be quite helpful, especially for these long hour-long sessions. But this week we did hear from Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP, and she was asking Prime Minister Theresa May, Prime Minister's questions about cuts to Bristol City Council.
Kerry McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last night, Bristol Council set its budget. Very difficult decisions made more difficult because of the abject failure of the previous mayor to get a grip on the council's finances. It's taken a Labour mayor to face up to the challenge. But government cuts are making his task almost impossible. And devolution is simply asking us to do more with less. We did our bit last night in setting that budget. Will the Prime Minister now meet with the Mayor of Bristol to discuss the fairer funding deal that the people of Bristol deserve?
Prime Minister!
I understand that my right honourable friend, the Community Secretary, has indeed had such a meeting to discuss the issue that the honourable lady raised.
That was a very quick reply, wasn't it? Martin, I suppose the irony here is, I sort of touched on earlier on, is that George Ferguson, it seems, when he was mayor, as an independent mayor, did almost everything he could to sort of push back these cuts so they didn't happen. It looks like Marvin's going for broke. He's going to do all the cuts the government want.
Well, I think both Marvin and George try to do their best with a very poor hand of cards that they were dealt. I mean, if we've got to balance the budget, as Jeff says, you can't get out of the fact that you've got to carry out cuts. Of course, you can moan, and we should moan, but I think what we really need to do is to get the central government to recognise.
Well, look, I'm saying here is that George was a naughty boy. He sort of juggled the figures and he tried to stop the cuts.
I don't accept that.
Whereas actually Marvin has been a good boy. He's making all the cuts that Westminster wants.
The fact is that the this is a tightening screw. It's a continuously tightening screw, and I think there is the central government are going to have to confront the fact that if they want local government to exist, and they claim they do, then they're going to have to fund it to some, you know, degree more than they are now, and make the cuts somewhere else if cuts have to be made. We can go into an issue about whether we should make cuts or not. As Jeff pointed out earlier, we haven't in fact got the deficit down in one parliament or even two, as was claimed to be the case. It's not going to happen. It was never going to happen in the first place. But I think we're now talking about getting rid of fundamental core tasks of local government, and I think that across the nation, including in Conservative controlled suburban areas, local authorities are not going to be happy to be completely eviscerated, and they're quite right to moan.
Jeff, what do you think of the quick reply there?
Just one point, first of all, I mean, George didn't squirrel things away or not face up to it. We faced up to what we thought we knew, and what's come out since has undermined that, but there was no attempt to conceal. Now, the issue remains that the only time that one can make an impact on the funding of local government, ironically, is in the general election once every 5 years. And what a lot of people who argued that the mayor should set an unbalanced budget don't realise is that that option does not fall to local government to do. So Marvin has no option but to produce a balanced budget, which means he has to implement these cuts, which is what they are, in order to bring about a balance.
Okay, so what about my point that George was a naughty boy? You think that's wrong? I mean, you're saying there was no attempt to conceal. Well, the officers, it seems, did conceal some of this.
The report says that, but what I'm saying is that George and his cabinet did not deliberately do that.
What would be the motive of somebody? I mean, you can understand in a commercial business, you know, say somebody in finance wanted to conceal something, but this is a local government.
Absolutely.
There should be
it
no
beggars
motive.
Belief. I mean, I have always worked, in the whole of the time I've been involved in local government, on the basis of trust, that the people who provide me with information are providing me with correct information, because without the provision of correct information, you're not in a position to either scrutinise or make management decisions.
Well, so is there going to be any comeback on these officers that have concealed the figures?
What the Mayor announced on Tuesday is a second inquiry to actually now find out who was responsible and what was concealed. So that he has announced, and that is the next stage of the process.
Okay, the next story is Olympus head teacher asks parents for donations as budget cuts drive schools to crisis point. A head teacher's been forced to ask parents for regular financial contributions as the government budget cuts leave schools at crisis point. Dave Baker, Chief Executive Officer of the Olympus Academy Trust, OAT, in South Gloucestershire, has written to parents about the effects the cuts will have on the trust school, basically offering, putting out the begging bowl to all the parents, please help fund your school. He's also saying that school days could be shortened to save money at seven schools. Pupils at seven schools could have shorter days after a trust head says, this is Dave Baker again, Chief Executive of the Olympus Trust, which operates around Bristol, said government cuts had left it at crisis point. Parents described the funding problem as diabolical. A union said the idea was terrible, but families deserved to know the truth about funding. Department for Education spokesman said new funding plans would increase the trust budget by 2.4%. Olympus Trust runs one secondary, one all through school, and five primary academies in South Gloucestershire in the north of Bristol. The letter, Mr. Baker warned parents of the unthinkable decisions the trust could be forced to make from September. So they're talking about turfing the kids out early, Martin.
Yeah, well, I used to work for the Olympus Academy Trust until very recently. Well, I mean, there's pressure on public services across the board. What is infuriating to people working in the mainstream system is the free schools which have been set up, many of which have proved not to be viable and had to be closed, which are basically an ideological obsession of the government instead of funding the existing schools.
Jeff, this is pretty appalling, isn't it?
Well, it is, and you know, you've just been asking me questions about Bristol's budget. The thing is about a city council or a district council like South Gloss is that they have 200 plus lines of services. What I'm slightly unsure about here with a school, which is effectively providing one line of service, I don't know quite how budget pressures suddenly arise in February.
Okay,
because that suggests that they've been spending more money than they had allocated throughout the year. So I would have a lot of questions I'd want to ask before I really commented any further.
Okay, our final story, and Kevin Carhill's joining us for this. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah.
Which is Ted Heath apparently was a paedophile, says police chief. Astonishing claim is made. The former Prime Minister is guilty of vile crimes covered up by the establishment. It was splashed all over the Mail on Sunday, wasn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, and I saw that.
Jeff, this is your former Prime Minister, Conservative Party.
Do you know, I find any of these cases extremely difficult to comment on. I'm a patron of a charity called the Southmead Project, which deals with victims of sexual abuse, and I know that therefore those who suffer have really desperate issues to raise, but it's very hard when we're going back to events a very long time ago.
Okay.
Very hard to comment and very hard to gather evidence. These have been...
Okay. Sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off there. It's time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest. That was Jeff Gollop, Conservative Cabinet Member for Finance, ex, and Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim. After the Murdoch News, The Guardian warned us last week...